Okay, least I can answer the first one.
What is your full name?
Jacob Byron Rohnbaum.
And where do you currently reside?
1111 Mocha Lane, Kinsley, Kansas.
And when and where were you born?
Fellsburg, Kansas, 11/6/31.
And what were the names of your parents?
My mother's name was Mildred. My father's name was Gordon.
And your mother's maiden name?
Shank.
And how about your grandparents?
Well, let's see. Grandma Rohnbaum was Nora Rohnbaum. Didn't know my grandpa.
It was Nora?
Yes. And my grandfather Shank was Henry. He lived in St. John.
And his wife?
Don't know. He'd been remarried, and I don't remember what grandma was. The only thing I remember.
Okay, describe the makeup of your household when you were growing up. Brothers, sisters?
Well, I had two sisters, one older and one younger.
Their names?
Doris was older and Virginia was younger. They're both alive.
And what was it like in your house? You were the only boy then?
I was the only boy, and how do I want to put this without cussing? I got blamed for everything. They came from Ohio, and I really don't know other than I guess they was looking for a better life.
They were farmers?
Yes.
And they've been back in Ohio, too.
I would assume.
Is this your grandparents?
Yes. My dad was born the same place I was born, there on the farm. He was born in 1895.
You know when they came? Was that about...
No, I don't know. They'd been there before that, but I don't know how much longer.
Were they original homesteaders? Or did they
Yes.
Okay, we wanted to do a little background to World War II. And, well, maybe first, you said you got picked on a lot, or you got blamed a lot.
That's right.
And you were the only boy. What kind of a farm was it? Was it both cattle and?
Yes, we raised cattle and we also raised wheat and some milo at that time. We had some third row corn, and the main reason for the third row corn was to keep the ground from blowing where it was. Our ground was awful sandy.
What do you mean by third row?
Well, there'd be two rows in between. There wouldn't be anything. And we had drills that would drill wheat in between those rows of corn. It wasn't all that way, but quite a bit of it. It was a conservation method to help protect the ground from blowing.
What's the soil out there? Fellsburg?
Sandy. I'm a sand rat.
Then you had chickens?
Yeah, we had chickens. Had chickens and hogs and had turkeys, geese. They were everything.
So as a child and teenager, what were your chores, or what was life like for you?
Well, I carried the coal to the house because we had a coal stove.
Did you have electricity?
We did, but it was from a cooler deal, which created a low voltage electric deal throughout the house.
What do you mean, a cooler deal?
A cooler engine that created. And I'd never understand it, because I wasn't too old when the electricity came in.
What ran the engine?
I don't remember.
Propane? Or
no. Coal? Wouldn't have been propane, because we didn't have propane at that time.
Maybe gas then?
Must have been. I just don't remember. Okay. It was in the basement of the house, what we call the wash house, away from the house.
So you carried the coal, and what else?
Oh, I milked the cows and gathered the eggs.
How many cows?
Oh, one or two.
The sons? enough for the families.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what else did I do? Or what else did we raise? Oh, hell, I don't know. We had the normal things that you had at that time, which was mom made butter. And we butchered there at the farm. Some of the neighbors would come in and help. Usually butchered a hog or two. We had in one of the outhouses, we had a great big box full of corn. And in that corn would be the hams and the bacons. We'd smoke the hams and the bacons. And then when my dad was through doing that, he would put them in this big box and pour corn all around it. The mice wouldn't bother.
Wouldn't bother the corn?
That's right.
Huh.
It made it stay the same.
Did the corn help the ham, keep preserve the ham too, or was the ham?
It was just there as a protection to the to the hams and I don't know, it was a great big old box had. You know, at that time you didn't really understand why we did anything, but that's what it was for, and that's how we preserved our meat.
Did you do that butchering in the fall or in the winter?
Or? I'm sure it was. It was probably in the fall. I don't know. I don't remember exactly what time it was.
Okay, during that time, you were born in 31, right?
So, yes.
What do you remember about the dirty 30s and the Dust Bowl?
That you couldn't see anything when it came rolling through. We had lots of rags at the doors and the windows. We walked around with wet washcloths a lot so we could continue to breathe.
Over your mouth?
Yes. The house that my folks lived in was moved there when the town of Greensburg folded up. And there'd been a hurricane come, or a tornado come through there, and they rebuilt part of it. And there was no insulation in the house. There was just the siding and then the plaster on the inside. No boxing or nothing. It was pretty open. So a lot of that dust and dirt come right on through. We, one time, my older sister and I found a snake in a turkey nest. We went back to the house, and Grandma Roenball lived with us at that time. And she grabbed a spade or a hoe, and by the time we got back out there, the snake was gone. But she had to lead us back to the house because the dust bowl, the dirt came in, and you couldn't see. So we naturally caught a hold of her hand, and that's how we got back into the house. This is when it was really bad.
How far is Fellsburg from Greensburg?
20 miles.
So they moved that house 20 miles?
Mm-hmm.
They're the same.
Well, I don't know how they got there, but they did. There were several houses. The house that Susie and I started living in redid. It was moved there. It's just set on a stone here and there, or a block, with no foundation under either one of the houses. And naturally, the varmints and everything would come around. I took and got metal in rolls and then nailed it to what was left of the house and put it around the outside of the house to keep the skunks out mainly. Because there was times when they would get underneath the house, and that, you know what that creates, a lot of smell. When our kids' children were little, there was lots of days they sat in the corner. We had a card party there one night, and they started screaming, "The skunk's dead." And I told everybody to get everything they had, lipstick, shoes, anything, and get the hell out of the house. And not all of them wanted to believe me, and some of them had trouble getting out of the house. But that's just what happens with houses that was moved in like that and no foundation put underneath them. But we had the same problem, both houses.
Do you remember the depression at all or any effects of it? You were, again, a young person. But.
Well, I don't know exactly what all we did without. You know, as a little kid, you really don't know. But we made it. We did without this and that. Mom bought flour and stuff like that in sacks so she'd make her skirts or aprons or whatever. She made a lot of the clothes the girls wore. We didn't hurt for anything. We were fortunate enough, our health stayed pretty good most of the time. So I guess that's about the best that I could answer that.
The advantages of living on a farm is you didn't go hungry.
That's right. That's right. Mom would go catch it. She had a regular little deal. She'd go catch an old chicken out there and wring its neck. She already had the water working. Scald it, and we'd have something to eat. My dad couldn't work. He was dependent on somebody to do most all of the work. And so consequently, I was not very old, and I learned how to milk a cow. And the reason he couldn't work, he had a double hernia. He'd been operated on when, I don't know. But made it a little tough in a sense that he couldn't ride a tractor either.
So
he couldn't pick up anything.
Did he hire people or neighbors?
He'd hire whoever he could, or I did it. And we always had hogs. So that.
How many acres did you farm?
Oh my goodness, I don't know. 700 or 800, I suppose. Maybe not that. Well, it would have been with the grass. I don't remember a whole lot. They put me on a 22 Caterpillar. And if you know what a Caterpillar looks like, you understand that you sit down in there. It's a little, you have to climb up over, get in. They felt like I probably wouldn't fall out of there, and I did that pretty young in life. I don't know how old I was. But I was driving a pickup at 7.
So you were doing the Caterpillar shortly thereafter?
I was driving the tractor part of the time.
You were the, had to be a little well, bit of the maid of the house pretty early then.
Well, not necessarily that. But we usually, help was easy to get at that time. Everybody looked for a job.
Oh, because of the depression.
Uh-huh.
Was the help live-in help, or
did
they just...
Usually, we had another little house, lived down the street road a quarter of a mile, and that's where they lived. I remember one day, this guy and his wife, we had him picking corn. And she always rode with him. One day, she didn't ride with him. The next day she did, but she was carrying a baby. She stayed home that one day, had that baby, was back on that wagon riding with him the next day. I say the next day I might be off a day, but maybe 2 days, but it wasn't any more than that. And it was, we put the corn in cribs. We did not... He didn't have combines. He had a sheller of some sort. And my dad did have a grinder that ground the cob and all. And he fed the cattle that way.
And then he took the corn to Bellsburg elevator?
No, he ground it all. He fed it right there at the place.
Okay. So you didn't sell any corn. What about the wheat?
Hauled it to the elevator, I guess, in Fellsburg. Because it was all hauled in by, at that time, by, oh gosh, those old trucks didn't hold much.
Do you remember the train, Nancy?
Oh, yes. I was in the fourth grade when they took that track out of there, quit that train. I rode it to Kinsley a time or two. I was going to school there at Fellsburg. They had a two-room school and then the high school. And the first six grades were in the two-room school. And I went there for 4 years, fifth and sixth. In the fourth grade, they moved to sixth grade. I don't know. I think it was in the... They took the high school because they didn't want to buy buses. They didn't want to get... So they went to Truesdale, which is 5 miles east. And so my first 6 years was in Fellsburg. 2 years of it happened to be in the big school building. The first part of heated lunches was that you took a bowl with something in it, and they'd put it in some hot water or something, and that was the first as I ever knew of a hot lunch.
So you took a bowl of soup
and... Yeah, or something like that,
stew.
Yeah. And that was early in the year. I walked to school a big part of the time because it was about three-quarters of a mile across the country, a mile around the road. We were always first on, last off. And so when I was in grade school, I went to Truesdale 2 years, seventh and eighth grade.
That would have been the war years.
Yeah. Yes. Let's see. 8 and 9 and 10, I went to Centerview School 3 years, which was 5 miles to the west of Fellsburg.
How did you get there then?
They had a bus. And then I went back to Truesdale, 10, 11, and 12. For whatever reason, same reason today, lack of people, lack of money. And any time after the sixth grade, I could have gone to Lewis. All those buses come into Fellsburg to pick up kids who are in that area.
You know why you chose not to go to Lewis?
Well, yes, that was easy. I had friends who were going the other way and had relatives that lived at Truesdale. I didn't at center. You just go where you're told to go. You know, you don't. You either walked. I never did ride a horse. I always walked. I was past that stage, I guess.
Did you have horses on the farm?
Oh, yeah. Yep. And they worked them in my early years.
Wagons, or?
Yes. That's what they're picking this corn with.
Okay, let's see. You would have been 10 years old on December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day at all?
Yes. I was in Truesdale at a function where my grandmother lived. And it was just something that happened. You know, it was, why did it happen? We didn't know. You know, communication, we just knew it happened. You don't have the television, you don't have, wasn't such a thing. We did have telephones.
Did you hear it on the radio? Or?
I think so, yes. But we were over there for a family function of some sort.
It was a Sunday. Do you remember any of the conversation of the adults? Or?
No, I was always outside playing.
Were there members of your family, the uncles or whatever, that were in the military?
My dad did not pass a physical. He couldn't pass a physical. And consequently, I enlisted. I would have been drafted, but I enlisted. And when I went to the service, he didn't know who would be doing the chores if somebody didn't show up. But anyway, did I have any aunts or uncles?
Well, I mean, for, you know, during World War II, was your family affected?
No, I don't think so. I had cousins. I had cousins that was in the service. I knew they were there when they got home, all of that. And you hear some of the stories they had to tell, and I don't remember any of the stories.
Were they in the Army? Or?
Yes, let's see. Dee Loss and Thurman. Tom was never in the service. I think they were both in the Army.
Do you know where they were deployed?
No. No, I don't remember.
So you don't remember if they enlisted or if they were drafted?
Well, I would say they were probably drafted. I enlisted because I didn't want to go into the regular Army. The other thing is, when I went in, there was a man in the community named Emil Fisher that had got involved with the Coast Guard. And I imagine he recruited, like, I think I counted at one time, like 23 kids out of this county that went into the Coast Guard. And it was all right with me. I thought it might be just as good or better than the Army. Because most of the ones that was getting enlisted at the time I went in, went right into the Marines. And why I didn't want to go there, I can't answer that, other than I did enlist and went into the United States Coast Guard for 8 years, 3 years active duty. The other 5 years, they could have called me anytime. Didn't, thank goodness. And then while I was in the service, I got married.
Okay, let's hold that thought and stay with World War II for a minute, and we'll come back to that. How about, do you remember people in the community that went into the service?
You know, I really don't. I don't. I know they were. I knew who that they were there, and you know, we had rationing at that time.
What was rationing?
Everything, almost. You know, you had to have coupons to get gas. You had to have coupons to get tires, if you could buy them. Let's see, I would say, I think sugar was hard to get. You know, it was something that, you know, I wasn't the one doing it, and I just lived with it. And what some of the other things that happened along that line, shoes. Sometimes you couldn't get shoes. Remember one time we took a trip, it must have been about, I'm a sophomore, maybe a junior. Probably a sophomore. We took a trip and went back to Ohio. And we put off going for a couple weeks because we needed a couple tires for our car. And finally, Jack Molitor got him in. A man that lived here in town. Friend of my dad's. And when we got back to Ohio, which was either New Philadelphia or Dover, I don't know, one or both those towns, I was walking around town. I walked into a tire store, and there was a tire stacked up there. It looked like a mountain to me. They weren't. And I said, "Would you sell me one of them?" I said, "I'll sell them all to you." We couldn't get them, and we had to have a permit to get them here in Kansas. But they had plenty of them back there. Now, maybe for whatever reason, I don't know. You know, and I asked my dad about it. I said, "Why don't we buy a couple of tires?" He said, "We really don't need them. We don't have the money to spend on them."
Had you gone to Ohio to see relatives?
Yes. Yes. And when I was... it must have been a sophomore, maybe a junior, probably a sophomore. A cousin, second or third cousin from Ohio, came floating through here in a Model A. He went clear to California and came back to here. His name was Bob Ruinbaum. And he worked at different places around. He's still alive. He lives in winter in Phoenix and the summer in Topeka. But it was part of that family that we went back to see.
Now, would that have been, because that was during the war you did that, would that have been unusual for people to travel during the war? Or?
Probably was.
And you probably went by automobile rather than train.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I think we went in a 41 Ford car. I'm pretty sure that's what we did. Because my dad ended up giving it to me later on. I suppose I was graduating in 49. He must have given it to me in 49.
Did your family own the land by this time?
Yes. Yes. The part of it was part of this deal that the government, you know, they bought it actually from the government. Parts of it. I don't know. I can't remember exactly which piece. I could probably look it up. But my dad didn't wear other than his sisters. He had three sisters. We didn't do without anything. It's just like I told my kids growing up. They didn't, anything they wanted they got, they just had to wait to get it. And it was the same thing then. Our wants wasn't, we didn't want very much. We didn't know about everything in the world. We didn't know what was going on very many miles away from home. We used to come to the Old Settlers Picnic here in Kinsley. As a kid growing up, we always looked forward to that. And we ended up in 4-H.
Do you know about how old you were when you started 4-H?
Oh, gosh. Probably, what was it, 19, 18, 17, 15, 14 or 15, I don't know. But it was something that that a lot of the kids did, you know. It was, you got to go and do a few things. We usually had livestock projects, and the girls had, my older sister wasn't in it, Virginia was. They had sewing and various things, food products. But the livestock deal was, it was controlled by just a few people. And what I mean by that is, there was one or two people in this county that made damn sure their kids had the champion stuff. And the rest of us made up for competition. I remember one year there was a heifer that won the fat stock, fat steer, whatever, fat calf. The next year there was 100 and some fat steers. I usually had one or two. The last year I was in 4-H, I had a deferred fed project. And I helped a lot of kids, including my sisters, younger sisters, Doris wasn't there, get their calves ready to show. And a lot of them had two calves, and I'd show one of them. And Joe Lewis from Larned was the judge. And I got the... And he would pick out different ones for showmanship contest, which I think should still be that way. But anyway, it changes. Changes are usually good. But the board would not let me show in that showmanship contest. They said that I didn't have a calf to show of my own. I says, and I had done more work than the majority of the rest of them. And, you know, I didn't ever get over that. And I didn't ever, I didn't really dislike those guys, but I didn't forget them. I saw one of them, he lives in Nebraska one time, Lewis at the cafe, several years after that. I reached over and shook his hand, and I told him I was still mad at him. And the thing about it was, most all of us knew who was going to win the showmanship. My, it turned out to be my brother-in-law, showed dairy cattle. And you couldn't beat him when it came to showmanship. You couldn't beat him. He won all the time. And rightfully so. But there were some people in the community that went out and bought high-priced calves so that they could win. And, you know, that's just some of the things that you learn by it. We ended up doing somewhat the same, only they, like this one person, they'd have three or four calves that they were fattening out. One year, meat rationing was on. You could not, regardless of how fat your cattle was, they had a ceiling on beef. That was all that you could get for it, like 25 cents, I think it was, a pound, $25, $100. And there was 10 of us, 8 or 10 of us, that took our calves to the Wichita Fat Stock Show. And we got 50 cents a pound for our calves. I had two that year, and I sold Murray Morris and my dad one of them and charged them what their going price was, which made that calf lose money. But the one I sold in Wichita made enough more that I broke even. But most 4-H projects don't make money.
Now, would that have been during World War II or after World War II?
That would have been that would have been in the meat. I said meat being rationed. I don't know that meat was rationed. This was for live livestock. They had a. And see, I graduated in 49, so it would have been in 47, 48, probably 47 or 48. And the war was over when? In 45, 46, see, it would have been right after that. And they used to have iron drives where, you know, they sold, like, our 4-H group went together and found all the iron and sold it and give it to the cause. There was a lot of people bought war bonds at the time. And
did that stuff linger because of the Korean conflict? Was still going, because that just ran right in.
I suppose it did. I don't know.
Was the iron drive during World War II?
Two. It was, or at the end of it. At the end of it. You know, that, cause I remember we were loading these trucks and one of the guys had a truck. Lived out in the community, he accused me of breaking his back window in his truck, and I didn't do it. He didn't believe me, but I didn't do it. You know, little things like that sometimes you remember. I don't know who threw what up there, but I wasn't the one that did it. And, of course, I was the youngest one in my class. And I should have been held out another year. It's easy to say that. I was 1 year behind my older sister. My younger sister was 3 years behind me. But they wanted to get me out of school so I could work quicker. That's what it amounted to.
But you did stay and graduate.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Your sisters graduated.
Yeah. And they both graduated from college. I went to college 2 years. And went to the service. Girls.
What'd you get credit for studying in college?
Oh, I just took a general course. I remember I started at Kansas State University. And I was totally lost. And I had a couple of cousins that was going to Topeka at Washburn. I went to Manhattan or Kansas State 1 week and transferred to Washburn and went to school at Washburn instead of Kansas State. The Dean of Women enrolled me at Washburn. We became very good friends. And she said, well, it says here you don't need bonehead ignition. I said, and I do. She said, okay, I'll put you in my class. And that was fine. And she asked me to stay in one day after class. Now, Rosetta's sitting over and been awful quiet. I'm going to use her. She may get mad at me, but that's all right. She'll get over it. She said, do you know Rosetta Graff? I don't remember this girl's name. I said, sure, I know who she is. What's the matter with her? She said, she's awful homesick. She said, she needs to get more involved. And wondered if somebody in our fraternity that I belong to, or me, or somebody, would. I said, I'll look into it. I knew what this girl was doing. She was sneaking out most every night with somebody. It wasn't me. See? And so she finally, I think she got caught. And she asked me to stay in again. And she says, why didn't you tell me? And I says, you didn't ask. So Rosetta got, I don't know whether she stayed in school or not. Now, see, we got you involved in this, too.
Better make it clear that was
her name.
Fictitious name.
That is a fictitious name. I don't remember where the girl was from. I never did take her out. But there was two or three of them. They had women's dormitories, and they...
That was back when they had rules.
That's right. That's right. And they finally figured out when she was just too damn tired from out partying every night. and this teacher, we became real friends. I went back and saw her after I got out of the service. And that was a time when they had a lot of military people come back, and they had a deal where they could go to college on some kind of a basis. Yeah, and she made comment that's when teaching in schools really changed. It's when they when they had the GI Bill and they got lots more of those people, and they were older. They weren't just out of high school. They had spent two or three years somewhere, and they'd come back to get an education. She said it was where colleges, the students, what you taught, and the things that happened. We're a lot different. She expanded on that.
That would have been one of the big changes that the war brought along.
That's right.
That you don't really.
That's right.
An educated generation.
Yeah.
But they also were interested in education.
Yeah. Well.
They were serious about it.
They had places for them to live. You know, they had dormitories for them to live in if they wanted to. Even at Washburn, that's a private school. Still is. Oh, yes and no, I suppose. They had this much trouble then, maybe more so than they do now. I'm getting quality teachers. I guess I called them 90-day wonders. We had a lot of military people that were officers and went to school for certain school and had what have you, 90 days and become an officer. We had teachers. I can't remember exactly what all. I called them 90-day wonders because they had a certificate to teach as long as they kept going back to get higher, more education. and they're really good teachers. They weren't to be had. And I'm not going to say that the ones that we had at that time were any poorer, or any worse, or any better. You know, if you can get an education wherever you're at, if you pay attention and listen, and not talk so damn much.
Did your teachers, wherever you were, did they live in the community? Or,
yes.
Did they go to school? Did they entice them to be there?
At Fellsburg, they had a place or two there in town where the teachers lived. And at Center U, they did. Well, they did all of them, you know. And there was one or two teachers that we had that drove out from Kinsley. I can't remember even their names. I don't remember. That's when I quit learning.
I had another question when you were talking about 4-H and stuff. Did you have the state fair at that time?
Yes. Did you
show it?
I didn't. The only place I went was to the Fat Stock Show in Wichita. If it had anything to do on weekends, if it had anything to do with after school, I didn't get involved in it. I had too many chores to do. I went to a basketball game late one night, second team basketball game over at Maxville, and I didn't call home and tell my folks. And when I got home, I didn't think we'd win, and we did. And I didn't get to play much. I didn't get in the house. There was an arm hanging outside the door with a bucket on the end of it. I went and got the cow when I got home. So, all that didn't hurt me. Of course, the old cow was anxious to get milk.
There's the cow. you played other team? Or
yeah. I got to play basketball. So
you got to play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Chores were lighter in the winter?
The chores were there. It didn't matter. You know, I told my dad one time, I said, "Pop, I tell you what, I'd get to play if you'd agree to take a group of the boys. They didn't go to ball games and buses. They went in individuals' cars." And I said, "If you'd agree to take some of us to the basketball game sometime," I said, "I'd get to play." "You know what you're talking about." I said, "The hell I don't." And so he did. He did agree. And I did get to play. And it was just like it is now, a little brown nosing.
Well,
what
your father
have you.
Was sitting there, too.
But we all went in cars. We didn't have, they didn't take buses. And that, let's see.
Who did you play? Did you play Maxville?
Oh, yeah, I played Byers and Maxville and Hadley. Center View, Coach. There in high school we played Pawnee Rock, played Radium. Have you heard all those towns?
Okay, well then, do you remember the end of the war? Anything specific about
BJ? No. No, I can't even tell you where I was at. What year would that have been in? 50? 45, no.
And the bombing of Hiroshima?
Yep, that was a big day.
You remember that?
Yep, that was a big day. I'm not going to say it was wrong or right. It's easy to look back. It solved lots of problems. It created just as many as it saw.
Do you remember the guys coming home?
Yes and no. I just knew they did, but as far as any big celebration, I wasn't privy to it.
said that the community supported the guy through the metal drive and war bonds. And of course, participating in the rationing. Was there anything else you can remember?
Oh, we had a speed limit at that time. 35 miles an hour. 35 miles an hour, and when you went anywhere, why, you know, you just planned, it just took longer. It took longer to get wherever you wanted to go, like going to Wichita, I remember times we'd go one day and come back the next, but the reason for that was I had an aunt that lived in Wichita, and we had a place to stay. Had we had to rent a room, we wouldn't have, we'd have come home. And my dad very seldom ever went, you know, like with Mom to Wichita if she was shopping or whatever.
Well, then would you go on the train to Wichita?
No, we'd drive.
Okay. Did your mother drive?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, she drove right up. She's 93 when she died. I suppose she's still driving at 89 or 90. I don't know. She drove actually more than my dad did.
Do you remember if there were any war casualties from your area?
No. No, I really don't. I'm sure there probably were. I can't think of who it would have been. Not any real close friends or what have you, relatives that were. Wasn't long you see some new cars. That was one of them. And the rationing, it stopped. At what point, I don't really know. You know, we had coupons, and people would trade coupons around for various things. You know, the rationing part. And I'm sure that's how we got back to Ohio. We had somebody else's gas tickets. But, you know, you didn't drive very fast. Consequently, I'm not sure what the cars didn't do as good or better on gas mileage. I think we need to shut this thing off for a little bit.
Okay.
If you would, I'll come back.
So it's easy to think of different things at different times, and mm-hmm. You would think I would remember a whole lot more. I think I should know you.
What interests a child? Oops, we don't have our microphone on. What interests a child? I'm going to really be loud. You know, you had a different life than the adults.
Well, that's true. That's true. And you know, my dad couldn't work, so consequently, I don't ever remember not having chores, regardless of how old I was. I had a bunch of cousins that lived at Truesdale that they didn't have the same, and they went to more shows, did more things. I just knew I wasn't going to get to it. I remember one time we was getting ready to move at the hog trough, and my dad was standing at the fence talking to somebody, and I couldn't move it. And I had a stick or something trying to pry it around. And I looked up and I asked him, I said, God damn it, can't you help me? And I think that's probably what I said. And he did. And it was 3 weeks before he got over it. He just couldn't do it. And I know now what he was, because I can't do it today. I can't do anything. I can't walk very far.
And that had to be very frustrating for your father.
It was. It was, actually.
Your relationship with him was
good, very good. Yeah, he drank a lot of whiskey, but he taught me a lot of things.
So overall, I had a lot of chores, but it was a good childhood.
Oh yes, yes. Yeah, and my sisters, I waved to them goodbye. They always going somewhere with their friends. I was either on the tractor doing something.
They had a lot lighter chores.
I don't know.
Well, now had you gathered eggs.
Well, I don't know what their chores were. They were in the house.
They had the women's.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, I'd ask you before we broke there, do you remember because of the air base at Pratt, and I know there was bombing runs at the practice.
Yes. I remember those airplanes coming and going, and I knew they were making practice runs some way or somehow or another, either out of Pratt or Wichita. And when you go to Pratt, you had to go actually through a part of the edge of the base. You always wondered as a kid what was going on over there, and same way with the airplanes. And I'm old enough to remember when the airplanes first started flying, and naturally, hey, you go look, wonder who's on, who's running. And you still do the same thing today.
Did you learn to identify the different planes?
No. Well, big ones and little ones, and the fighter planes once in a while, they would come out of, I don't know where they come out of, whether it was Wichita, I don't think it was Pratt. I don't know where they came from. Every once in a while they'd be flying real low in formation, and most usually it would spook the cattle, because here's not only noise, you'd see the silhouette of the plane, the shadow of the plane down, and it comes and goes so fast you don't know. And that happened a lot, and they had different runs. Pretty soon you kind of got used to them. Had different runs to go to different places. I assumed they were dropping bags of flour. I don't know what they're dropping. I know there was one over here south of town, and I've heard of another one or two. I don't even remember where. It's just something that happened.
So. There was more than one bombing range in Edwards County?
This one, it seems to me like, Rosetta, that I want to say there was, but I can't tell you where it was at. I'd like to say it was up north up here. North, maybe it was another county. I don't know. I know the one south. But I probably ought to just say there was just one, because I can't tell you where the second one was. Well, it wasn't good. Nothing like it is good, but it affected my life. I'm sure it did, but exactly if it hurt me some way, I don't know it.
No,
I was just too young enough that I was, I was the tail end of all of it, all of that. I went into the Corps Indio.
Right. So did World War II affect that decision or not? I mean.
No, I don't think so. When I was about to be enlisted, we had to draft at that time. And they were basically taking anybody if you're eligible, if you could pass the physical. And it's just something that you knew was going to happen. And we had several instances of guys getting off for various reasons.
Could you have gotten a farm deferment at that time?
I'm sure I could have. My dad wouldn't talk about it. He didn't go. He would have been in World War One probably. He didn't go because he couldn't pass a physical, and he felt like that. I think he had a feeling that I went in a sense because he didn't, or what have you. I don't know exactly how to put that, but he didn't. He probably could have kept me home. In fact, I know he could have. And when I was when I joined the service, I was in California in Oakland. Oakland, I guess, is where I was at. There was a young man from here in Kinsley that was in the same company that I was. I did not know him. He was born and raised north of town, out of town a ways. And after we got out of boot camp, I went to 11th school, Long Beach, and then went to Cook and Baker School in Groton, Connecticut. And in the meantime, where was it? I told him. I saw him someplace. I can't remember. He said he was getting out of service. And I said, how? I said, how are you getting out of service? He told me, and I thought it was wrong. And it was wrong. He wanted out so damn bad because his girlfriend was chasing somebody else. He thought maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. And his dad gave him half the farm and all the cows. And they got a deferment, got him out of the service because of that. I thought it was wrong. He went back to school afterwards, and he taught school somewhere. He didn't stay on the farm. You know, it was just one of those things. And that's fine. That was his life. He had to live with it. I didn't. But he was from here at Kinsley.
Well, how did your dad continue farming without you?
Well, he continued paying the bills.
He had to hire it done.
Very few people knew that. And I don't know, I don't remember all this, how he came to have this hernia. It was a double hernia. He wore a belt every day. And I was told it was operated on once. Well, I don't know where. I know a couple of my uncles, whenever they kind of got to where, if they went to Halstead, they were going to die. And I don't.
We are looking at pictures, Jake.
Well, I can scan that.
And there's a picture of he and his sisters.
Oh, there we go. How old were you there?
I don't know.
That oldest sister probably hasn't graduated yet. She's still in grade.
Yep. Yep.
I bet Doris looks like she's about 14, so I'll bet you're.
So this might be about World War II. So yeah, we
that
like
very easily could have been.
Like to scan that, or if you want to, we can give away.
Well, I'll see.
Well, you can just take the picture and do with it.
Right. Yeah,
take the picture
okay.
and bring it back.
I need to take this to what's your name? Thank you, so they can put it in the window.
Oh. Well, let me borrow it first, and then...
Yeah, okay. That's all right.
And Mickey's at the drugstore,
yes.
So I can take it.
Okay.
And turn that off, please.
I'll scan it for you.
I thought it might, there might be...
Where'd you find it at?
Some of your Coast Guard things in that current company.
That's where you've been?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this one is Doris.
Doris.
In
Virginia.
Virginia. You know that?
Would have taken
in
51? Well, it was right after I went into the service. February, 1st of February. They had it. I think it was in February of 52, isn't it? Yeah. Bill was born in 53. I was released in St. Louis.
Was there any motivation on your part to get away from the farm? Is that why you would have
been? No. No. If I hadn't had the farm to come back to, we'd ended up living in California. We had an aunt, Susie had an aunt and uncle lived in San Diego. We probably would have stayed there, but I'd, you know, you think about what you might have done. But no, I knew when I went in, well, that I would come back. You know, it was just when we got out of the service and we were married. We didn't raise anything on the farm. It was through some dry years. I think I was home either 2 or 3 years before we ever raised very much at all. It was just too dry.
You enlisted, and you were talking about that there was a lot of men from the area that went in the Coast Guard.
Yes.
You want to tell us a little bit about that and why?
I don't know what brought it all on. Amos, both of his boys were in the Coast Guard. Harold Rollison, Bo Smith, and I have several others. I said 23, but I might be a little, I'm probably too high on my numbers. That number stuck in my, of all the different people other than that he helped get in. And at that time, we felt like probably we went enlisted for 3 years. We could have gone into the Army for two. And it's kind of like anything else, I guess, whether you're in 4-H or what it is. You want to be a part of something. And I guess I wanted to be a part of the Coast Guard because my friends were there. And Carlene Wingfield was one. He's gone. Yeah, he's gone now. No, he isn't. He still lives. He lives at Pratt. But he was ahead of me in school at Centerview. But as to exactly why else, I don't know. I guess I didn't want to go into the Marines. The Army might have been all right. I don't know what my thoughts were 100% at that time.
Was there any thought that the Coast Guard was going to keep you in the States?
No, not necessarily, other than, well, I guess you'd have to say I stated that wrong, because you would think that you would not. The Coast Guard was under the Treasury Department at that time, and we were usually along the coast. We had places in Alaska and an office. I was discharged in St. Louis. Shoreline duties. We checked all the ships that come in out of the harbor, out of Los Angeles Harbor, Long Beach. What's that?
She found another one.
Oh. And they escorted the Navy a lot of times. But they were under the Treasury Department at the time when I was in there. I don't know who they're under now. But we had 12 Coast Guard districts. I was in the 11th one. We were in and out the harbor in Long Beach in Los Angeles Harbor. One night we went looking for a whale. that was supposedly in the harbor. We never did find it. He found his way back out, I guess.
So it was harbor safety.
Yeah, and we had the last ship I was on was the Minnetonka, and it was 225 feet long. It had a full complement of people. We dropped depth charges. We had the big guns, everything. I asked the gunner's mates when I got ready to get off the service for some antifreeze. They used antifreeze for lubricating those big guns. It was real slick, which it is, and it keep them from freezing up.
So the depth charges were done for enemy submarines?
Yes. And we went out in the harbor and played games with the Navy and did things like that. The last ship I was on a base in San Pedro for quite a while. And that's where there was three 83-footers is what I was on for almost a year. That means it was 83 feet long, had a complement of about 13 and one officer. And the officer was a 90-day wonder, as I call him. And he told me I could get a rate change, and what we were after was to get a better rate, and then we could get a little bit more money, naturally. And I had to cook a duck, bake a pie. There were three things I had to do, which wasn't hard to do. We bought all our groceries on this small boat that I was on, small ship, I should say, at a grocery store just like Jay's down here. It's called the Busy Bee Market in San Pedro, California. I would go in and order various things. If we needed something to do something with, like, we were allotted X number of dollars. And so, at the end of the month, we'd usually have a little extra money. And once in a while, we also had a dry goods box up on the in our place on the base, on the dock. And we kept it full of canned goods and stuff like that in case we got in trouble. But we would, I would order cigarettes for the guys. I did not smoke. And they'd charge it all off. Something else. One of the guys on one of the other ships came on there one day, and I was cooking, frying up some ribeyes. And where in the world did you get that? Well, I got it the same place you get your meat. Well, as it turned out, the butcher at the Busy Bee Market was from Newton, Kansas. And I got the center cut of everything if I ordered it. Which was great. We gave a lot of liberty. That way we had money. We could eat steaks when we wanted it. They did not like oleo. But to save money, I would save the oleo stickers, packages they're wrapped in. I mean, the butter ones. If I'd save them, I'd order oleo when they weren't watching, which was very, I could do it anytime. Rewrap the sticks of butter. In oleo, and they didn't know the difference. But anyway, we ordered plywood now and then to redo the galley and what have you. I could stand in one place, put something on the stove, on the table, in the refrigerator, and I was also the mess cook, and I did the worship and everything.
You were just you in the kitchen, basically.
Yep.
Did people come in for KP or something like this?
No. On the base we did.
And you did three meals a day?
Yep. If we were at sea. And when we were tied up, I got almost every night at liberty. I'd do extra work, but I got paid for it. And we had some Hawaiians on the ship. They had different duties, and they'd help you out. Different ones would help you out. And there, and on the big ship, they had took care of the officers, and they always played one card game. They were always playing this one game. And every now and then, one of them would take off and go to Reno. The little rascals were pretty smart. They always bought a round-trip ticket on a bus. And they usually come home on the bus with no money. And they'd usually win, but they couldn't quit. You know, they played all the time. They couldn't quit. And they would, this one got up 18, I don't know if some guys was there, said he had $18,000, $20,000. And he come home on his ticket. You know, that just part of the thing that went on. But on the 83 footer, we had an ensign who was an officer, and we had the chief bosun's mate, and we had a chief engineman. The chief engineman was a real nice guy, and I went and visited him with him one time, and he made an excuse for his wife not being there. He said, she's at church. I said, that's all right. He said, you know, every time we get transferred, and he was a long time man. He was getting close to retiring. He says, every time I get transferred, he says, she goes to church, and here comes the priest. He says, I just asked him, he said, you want me to join your church because you want me to, or I want to? You know, and I haven't forgot that. Do you want me to have this interview because you want to? Because I want to. Well, anyway, you remember some of those things. And on the 83 footer, the engine and the bosun's mate got into it. And the ensign was stupid, as far as I was concerned. He went to a dock and put him off. The fight didn't last long. They both got transferred, and they were both good men. You know, but he did it, I suppose, the right way. Only the engineman was a friend of mine. The other one was all right. This 83 footer had two Sterling Viking 600 horsepower motors, engines in them. They were gas engines. They sounded like diesel. We had two Model A Ford engines that run generators. That's how we generated electricity. And one day we picked a man up out in the ocean. His little boat had, well, he wasn't in the ocean. He was in the traffic way there inside the harbor. But he'd been out for a long time. And he made the statement. He says, we can't. He said, they told me that boat wouldn't sink. And he was holding on to it. We got him in. And the guys that had been on the ship for a long time knew what to do with him. They got him, wrapped him up in blankets, and took him down to the engine room. That was the warmest place on the ship. And I asked him whether he wanted soup, whatever, give him anything he wanted. And, you know, he didn't go into shock because he was too interested in watching those engines work and what they sounded. You know, it was the psychological thing that went along with it. Pretty soon he come down, and I'd give him whatever he wanted to eat. One day, we would go out and we'd patrol the harbor, and we'd take turns. You'd go out for a week, you'd be in for two or three weeks. And we knew that when we were due to go out, say, noon Monday today. Well, on the weekend, the Army base took 29 Boy Scouts to Catalina Island. And the storms come up. And they didn't think they could get back in that open boat. And we went and got them. We knew it was going to have to go. You know, they're too close to the Army. The Army base was right there. And, of course, the majority of them got sick. We had GI cans and stuff sitting around. And they could go anywhere. They could come down in the galley, but they could not go in where we slept, into the quarters. They couldn't go. And we brought them back. One time we headed to Catalina Island, and this one bosun's mate was on duty. And he looked around here like this, and he said, and I happened to be topside when he did it. For what reason, I don't know why I was up there. He said, you see a star right up there, yeah? And she'd go right to that star. She'd steer that course. And pretty soon they came up with the course that it was right where that star was. He knew where it was. We went right into a certain cove over in Catalina Island. You could see it. You could see the island. You know, we in and out of there. We never stayed there. We picked up a man. There was three of them, I think. Got in an open boat and headed to Catalina to decorate a bar. The red flag was flying. That means you don't go to sea. They went anyway, but they didn't get very far. And about, I don't know, two of them washed up on the beach not too long after that. And finally the third one surfaced. The water was cold. And as long as it was cold, he didn't blow up. He stayed somewhat preserved. And finally the temperature, the currents changed. And he surfaced and we had to go get him. And that wasn't fun. And you could see where the fish had been eating on it a little bit. But, you know, little things like that. One time we were south of San Diego playing drops and robbers with the Navy. And all of a sudden, here comes something up out of the water. I thought, what in the world is that? What was it? A submarine. There was always a submarine behind when they were having planes take off and on, landing. There was always a helicopter in front and behind, usually, in case something went wrong. And that submarine was back there. He surfaced. And it was kind of eerie feeling when you saw that thing come up out of the water. You know, just different things that happened. I remember one time when I was on the big ship, I thought, I'm going to pre-boil these French fries. You know what happened. And so I went directly to the executive officer who was right around the corner, and I told him what happened. I said, you want me to remake them, or you want me to feed them mashed potatoes? And he said, feed them mashed potatoes. Of course, everybody wanted French fries. And they gave me hell about that. And I said, the exec's right in there. Go ahead. Go right on. He knows already. I went to him first.
What was your reputation as a cook?
It was good. I liked to eat. I like to eat, and I season things to suit me. Most all of it was good food to start out with, is how it was handled. And the last 5 or 6 months I was on the big ship, I got to take care of the commissary goods. And that gave me every night and every week in Liberty. That's what she's after, or I was. I wasn't there for the long pool. And every now and then somebody would show up and said, Roanball, there's a petition. I says, thank you. And I'd go up to the top side where the guys that controlled the ship and the gunner's mates and what have you. And I says, have I ever failed to give you something when you wanted something extra to eat? You know, every now and then they'd get hungry, like anybody else. And now, maybe I wouldn't have what they had, but I'd give them a can of peaches or something. And we'd get that stopped. And I didn't blame them. I didn't blame them. Because some of those guys would murder that food, something terrible. When I was on the base waiting for the ship, I was off duty, but I had to be on the base. I was asleep. And the quartermaster came up and said, get up, Roanball, you got to go to work. I told him, go to hell. Rolled over and he said, the exec will be up. The officer of the day will be up here if you don't get up. I said, what's the matter? And he says, I said, hell, get that man right over there. He's the one that's in charge of the galley, not me. And they couldn't wake him up. He's drunk. He had taken hamburger filled one of them big pans plumb full, like this, stuck it in the oven, and went and passed out. And the galley was on fire because of that. The meat was on fire. So I went down there, and the officer came in, and I said, "Sir," I said, "this is not my fault." He said, "I know that." And I said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "I've got to clean this up first, but," I said, "what do you want me to feed these guys?" "Feed them whatever is the easiest or whatever you can." I said, "Well, we got canned hams, we got, you know, for sandwiches and what have you." And he says, "Whatever." I says, "You'll back me up on what?" "Yep, I'll do that." And he did. And he did. The inside of that hamburger was still frozen. Because he got the best liberty.
Okay, so let's back up just a minute, because let's see, you went up to Washburn for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
When did you meet Susie? And because you got married right after you.
While I was in Washburn school, I knew her. No, she is still in high school. Gerald Davis, and you don't remember him, but I don't imagine. Remember, Davis had a had a restaurant over about where the senior citizen deal is. Yeah, he was in school at the same time. He turned out to be a lawyer and was a judge at California at one time. But anyway, probably the first year I was there, I told him, I said, "Why don't you come home for Christmas?" And I said, "Why don't you get me a blind date with Mildred Fisher?" I said, "She can't act as crazy as she acts as whenever I happen to be around." And he said, "What if I can't get a date with her?" And I said, "Try Susie Etley." Well, she was going steady with somebody. She always acts goddamn crazy and silly. And so he got me a blind date with Susie Etley. Now you know the rest of the story. And
so that was love at first sight?
Not quite.
Not quite.
Not quite. I had to figure out how to get her away from whoever she was going with. I don't remember. But anyway, see, he got me back up to.
So then you.
But I was on the base at I went to Cook and Baker School in Groton, Connecticut. I came home and was on the base waiting for one of the ships to open up. I was on the 83-footer, and I'd been on it. I don't know when it was that my mom got burned real bad. It was, Susie was seven, eight months pregnant with Bill. It was after we got back to California from Connecticut, and my mom got burned real bad and was in the hospital. And I talked to my dad. He says, "How can you get home? Can you come home?" I says, "No." I said, "The only way I can get off of here is I threw through the Red Cross." And it wasn't the next day I was transferred. And I knew the guy that came and replaced me. Yeah. I knew the guy that was replacing me for short term. You know, there was a lot of people that were thieves, might as well say. And I was too, in a sense. But anyway, when I went back, I went down to the ship the night before I had to report in. And they said, "You know you've been transferred?" And I said, "Yeah, I knew it would be. I told my dad it would be." And I said, "Have you guys," and they were upset with the cook that they replaced me with. And I said, "Have you checked in the storeroom up?" Well, they just flew off that boat. He had taken everything out of that case. But I knew him, knew what he did. When I was, let's see, I'm jumping around on the, when I was on the, I can't remember exactly where I was at. Oh, I know where I was at. I was on the big ship when I got transferred to Minnetonka. Right after that, why, I had the opportunity to take the ship's truck and go get commissary goods. And I forget who it was. Didn't matter who it was with. We went by this one bar, and he said, "Keep going." I said, "Why?" Well, we had one of the cooks had gone after commissary goods at another place. Maybe I went after the mail. I don't remember. But he had stopped there. He owed a bar bill. He had stopped there, and he unloaded more cases of hams. There's six hams in each case, and I think there's like 20 or 30 cases of ham. And turkeys. And when he came back, when he got back to the ship, I told him, I said, "I know where you were at." And I says, "I'm not taking this hickey for you." He begged me not to turn him in. I said, "All right. Anytime I want something, just never say no." And so when we got around to taking the inventory, we'd have to inventory the goods every now and then. He said, "Tell me how many were short, how many cases of what were short." And it was cold down there where that stuff was at. And the officer was there just writing stuff down, and he'd read off such and such and such and such. I knew, and I was writing them down too. I knew that they weren't there. But he got by with it, you know. But he paid his bill. You know, little things like that happen. I watched the command, my division officer leave one day with 5 pounds of coffee early one morning. You know, you're just stealing it from yourself. But it did happen. It does happen. And but I enjoyed my stay when I was on the, wherever I was at. I worked at trying to get the best liberty that I could. I was married. I wanted to go home. When we were getting ready to go to sea one time on the Minnetonka, the officer of the day came aboard and just was madder than all get out. And he quarantined, that's not the right word for it, all cooks and mess cooks. He wanted that grill to where he could see his facing. And they went to scrubbing on. It's the only thing they could do. They had a stone there. They cleaned it. And I stand up topside, and he come by, and he said, "How come you're not down there helping them clean that thing up?" I said, "I didn't do it." I said, "Sir, I'm going to tell you something. What you're doing is wrong." He says, "Why do you say that?" I said, you can't cook anything on that thing like you want it." I said, "You can't put enough oil or grease on it to keep it from sticking to it." I said, "What you're asking for is wrong." And I said, "I don't mean to make you mad by telling you that," but it wasn't a little bit after that he turned them loose. But, you know, it was a punishment deal. And I had duty that night anyway, but I still went ashore because I jumped ship. Well, you know, we knew we were leaving the next for too many days, and I think that night Susie was in Kansas. She had come home for. She was in Kansas. She wasn't there at that time, but I still went somewhere. I don't know. But you know, funny little things like that happened. The officer, the commanding officer, when I got on the Minnetonka. I was on there for a month, and he finally come in the galley, and he asked me what my name was 5 times in a row. He says, "You know, this galley's my pet peeve," and I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If I come down here and you're sitting on your butt and there's a pee hole in that corner, I'm going to put you on report. But if you're doing something, I'll never say anything." Well, that's the way I made it happen. And he was that way, and he'd love to go to sea, but he'd be sick for the first week. Oh, well, I'm talking too much.
Well, no, I'm still trying to get the time frame here. You enlisted, and then you got married?
Yes.
And
I enlisted, went to Oakland, California, and we got married between being there, and I was transferred to Long Beach, California, and on my way I got married, and we went got married at 8 o'clock in the morning, left for California at 10 o'clock in the morning, and
Now, what did her family think about all this? How did they feel about it?
I didn't ask him. Other than I asked John for, to, if it's all right if I could marry Susie, and he said, he asked a few questions and said, yeah, guess so. Well, Bob and Nancy had already married and lived in Long Beach. But we...
Now, was Susie right out of high school?
No, she had been in 1 year of school at Lawrence. And we... dragged in there to Long Beach, California, and I reported into the base. She went to look at, find a place for us to live. We had a little apartment, had a pull down bed, out of the way. And
so your honeymoon was getting to
the honeymoon. The next day, basically the next day, we were driving.
Oh, you
were
driving.
Yep.
We drove.
Yep. That we did. That we did. But that, and then while I was at the base, wasn't there very long. And I suppose another reason I wanted to be a cook, because I knew Bob, and he that's what he was going to do. You know, I was just kind of a tag along, you know. And we were a month behind Bob at school, and Bill Chad. And Carl Wingfield was in, back there at the same time. So, you know, you kind of go where your buddies are.
When you were in the military, was there still segregation in the military?
No.
No.
No. We had a cook that was on the ship. This thing clicked, if you want. It doesn't matter. You want me to tell this story before or wait? We had a cook that I don't know where he was at for the first month that I was on the big ship. I heard about him. And
well, on the big ship, how many cooks were there?
Oh, there was probably six. We worked 24 hours and off 24, sometimes more or less. But anyway. Come to find out, him and the skipper of the ship had been in Alaska together. I don't think duty in Alaska was very nice, but I don't know. I didn't ever hear anything real bad or whatever. But undoubtedly, they could become friends. And he would come aboard, go right to the old man, and go back ashore. And one day... he came aboard and he went right to the exec's office. And the exec come in there and he says, you know what this man's saying? I said, sir, I just know he exists. I've never talked to him. I don't know him. I says, I don't know anything about him. I says, why would I want to do anything to help him? And he said, I said, tell me what it is he wants and I'll tell you whether I can. He wanted to have the next three. He said, if you'll stand his next, his watch, I think it was, he said, if I'd stand his watch, which was another 24 hours, he'd stand my next three. And I looked at the exec and I says, you know, you can't do that without, and me be off the ship without having to take leave. He says, it'll be all right. I said, sir, I believe you. And I said, I don't know how to protect myself other than I'll do it. Well, while I was gone, the ship moved. You don't move the ship without the full complement. And they called up and they said, the ship's moving, get your tail down here. I put on my uniform as Susie was driving down the street. And I went across the gangplank and they said, keep your mouth shut and put on your undress blues, or your dungarees, like you're working. And as soon as the ship tied up and dry docked, I put my uniform on and left. But I was there. Boy, at that time. This guy, we went down to the bottom of the ship. It was always wet down there, but we had some commissary goods stacked down there. He picked up this cook that I hadn't seen. He picked up two boxes and almost passed out. So it tells you that he was hopped up on something. What, I don't know. And he went ashore. But after this deal where he stole all the stuff, I told him, I said, you know, and he'd go after pastries and stuff. And he was unloading that stuff everywhere. You know, and here, I'm in charge of taking care of it. So I had to double check to make sure if there was 10 pounds of cake there or five. You know, I wrote down what it said on the paper. And sometimes we were short. And one day he went by the house where we lived and left a bunch of stuff. I don't, he's crazy. But, you know, it's an awful thing to say that there was that much stealing that went on, but I just happened to be in the middle of it. And people like to eat. And I like to eat, and I'd season stuff to suit myself. But I didn't blame the guys at all for getting a petition up to get me to go back to cooking. And I said, what do we do on this ship that we work so hard to get? They said, liberty. I says, I have every night and every weekend as long as we're tied up to a dock. I says, don't ruin that for me. So that, you know, that's a big part of. I got transferred off. The ship was going to sea. What we did, we go to sea about halfway between San Francisco, even though we were tied up in Long Beach, and we talked to all the airplanes going from Hawaii and back and forth. We give them a ditch course, and we give them weather. We sent up weather balloons every day, and they'd send weather back. And if they had plenty of time, the different guys would send messages back. They'd take and write down a bunch of stuff and, like, send it to you. You know, I did it one time. And, damn, I got ahead of myself. Oh, when I went to get off, the ship was supposed to leave. I was supposed to be released like February the 8th or something like that. And was going to be gone, and they wouldn't transfer me off. And they had the privilege to keep me and extend my enlistment. And that's what they were going to do. And I told Wayne White, another guy from here, you knew him, or knew of him, what was happening. He says, I can take care of that. He was a yeoman or a secretary down at the base. So he wrote up a transfer, a leave transfer en route to the Coast Guard District in St. Louis, and one letter to the ship's commander, one letter to the district commander, one letter to Washington, D.C. And, you know, I got transferred. My release was laying every morning. I got there before the exec did. I'd go and be right there on top of the list. He wasn't going to transfer me. So what happened after that? I don't know. I came home and went to St. Louis and got released from service. I had a few experiences over there in St. Louis. I'm sitting in this one bar. All of a sudden, the police showed up, and some guy went running by there, and they grabbed him, and then they started looking for the gun he had. And he'd reached underneath this car and put it right on top of that front tire. And they knew where to look. They finally found it. I sat in, inside this bar and watched them. And when I got released, there was a friend there. I'd made a friend. He was from, I don't know. He run tugs up and down the river. And I went through the train station running, and he had already taken my bags to catch this one train to Kansas City. And I kept telling him, I says, I'll be there, but I says, I'll get on, I'll be there. And every officer in that place hollered at me and demanded I stop and quit running. And I just kept going. And as the train was leaving, I stepped on the back of that train. So I wanted to go home. I wanted to come back to Kansas, back here. But that's basically,
sum up your experience in the Coast Guard. Was that a good experience?
Yes, it was very good.
What did it do for you?
Made me realize how big this world is, one thing. The other thing, Susie and I got to go and see and do. We didn't have much money. Our pay was not very good. We got to go and see and do things, and that's what we did to entertain ourselves. We didn't go to shows. But we got to see and do a lot of things that we would never, ever have the privilege to do again. Having lived on both coasts, we went into Boston one time. We was around New London, you know, all back there. Susie was pregnant when I got transferred to the school. They flew me back there one night. When I got on the airplane in Los Angeles, it was cool. When I got off in New York, it was hot. I sewed the stripes on my white uniform so that I could go ashore, because it was just too hot to wear them. And the experience I had back there, she came back, was great. You know, when you look back at it, the things that places we went, the things we got to see and do. I met a lot of people. You learn a lot about not only yourself, but about other people. The base that we were on was an old Wrigley's experiment. Mansion, yes, but what used to be something that they had. That's where the base was that they converted into the Coast Guard base. Once a month, we would get 1,800 lobsters on the base, and there wouldn't be a third of them eaten. We had fun fighting them. They some of them would get real mean. And one day I spent all afternoon breaking them open and taking the meat out of them so that we'd have lobster salad. And because of that, I don't really care for lobster anymore. But, you know, little things like that happen.
Do you still cook?
No. When I got transferred off the base at New London, Groton, whichever place it was, I had everything, my orders and everything. When it came to get paid, I couldn't get paid. And Susie, I had a friend that was going to Philadelphia, and I asked him if we could follow him. You know, going through New York, what have you. And they kept calling for me to show up at the gate, and I kept ignoring them. Finally, I went in and told this guy, I said, hey, I'm leaving, and I don't have any money. I said, you're not leaving. I said, we dig around and find you are, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, the only thing we got is fives and tens and twenties. And I said, anyway, just give me the money. And I run to the gate, and they were waiting, and we took off. And I changed into out of my uniform going down the street and followed him clear through to Philadelphia. And then we came on home, drove back to Long Beach. A lot of experiences, you know, like that. Not so much the people, but how the things worked. Why did things work the way they do? You know, you're told you got to do this, and that's it. You don't talk back. If you do, you make a few more rounds around the walking or running or whatever it is that the penalty would be. Pick up more cigarette butts. You know, that's just some of the things that happen.
So but, when you were discharged, you went immediately to Ellsberg?
Yep, yep. Yeah, once I, well, we we lived in Kinsley at that time. We'd come back. We lived in Kinsley. and went right back to the farm, yes. And we lived here in town, and upstairs, you know where Ted and Dolores Taylor lives? You know that place right across the street, or the apartment above it? That's where we lived. And then we moved to Truesdale in a basement apartment. And in the meantime,
one.
And we, while we were in Truesdale, my uncle Anthony Jennings, my mother was a Jennings, was a deaf mute. He couldn't talk. He couldn't hear, naturally. He married a deaf mute. They lived in St. Joe. And that's where we ended up remaking a house out there on that place. And it was moved in from Greensburg, just like the other one. And my father-in-law, John Antley, came out there and looked at that house. He says, hell, this place isn't fit together. Well, we were going to make it fit. So he had Clint Little come out there, and he scribed boards in the kitchen, like two sixes. In the middle, there wouldn't be a board, and come out like this to level it up. All right, he took the door and he cut the bottom part off and the top part off so it would work with the floor like that. Well, while we were living in that old house, they reevaluated this county. And this guy came in there to look at the house and he said, this place isn't fit to live in. And Susie just almost came unglued. I said, quiet. And so we all appealed it, and the guy that I had to talk to, he had never been out there. And I asked him, I said, were you out there when that? He said, no, I'm just reading what a man said. I said, let's start on 1626-17. I said, tell me about why you got that grain bin stuff on there. Well, he said, it's there in it. And I says, you know, you could put a cow in that grain bin. You couldn't keep her there. I said, it hasn't been used for years. He says, let's just write it off. And I knew right then it was a farce. It was going to be. Because anything, you know, I could prove anything from there on. And I said, hell, this is enough of this. And I got up and walked out and was grinning. Everybody wondered what I was grinning about. And I walked out. It hurt me in a sense. I had to go back and meet with the commissioners. I had to meet with some yahoo. I won't give him his name because he didn't have a good name. And the last time I went to meet with him, I took Terry Fuller with me because they were really trying to hang it to me, and they were out of line. And you know, you remember some of those things. And this was after, I don't know. Then they threw the whole thing out, the valuation of the tax deal. Valuation.
Yeah.
When I got back and went to farming, my uncle had 680 acres. And my dad, I'll tell it. My dad and mom went back to St. Joe, Missouri. Uncle Anthony had passed away. We had nothing in writing on farming this farm. And and while they were back there, they had taken my Aunt Mabel, Uncle Anthony's wife, with me, Mabel, glasses away from her. and they wouldn't let her go get any more. And I should have went to the dime store and took some with me. So when we got there, they'd give her some reading glasses to read just a little bit. And my dad told us what to do. He was so mad you can't believe. But anyway, he said, Susie, you talk about the pictures and things and get her to talking about things in her house and get her away from Aunt Mabel. And I handed Aunt Mabel this piece of paper, and she knew what it was. She immediately figured she wasn't a dummy. But anyway, she ordered a sign. She signed it, and I stuck it back in my pocket. So that they didn't know what it was. Well, the lawyer that had taken this deal over, that he had on the ground in Florida, and no one ever knows what happened to it. He stole whatever was in the house, put her in a rest home, and was about to steal the farm. But while we were there, some people from California showed up, part of her family. And, of course, they were mad at us. They thought, sure, that we were the ones who was trying to get the farm. Well, they weren't there very long, and they figured out what the problem was. And they took Aunt Mabel back to California with them. And in the meantime, they got this lawyer, took him to court, and got him disbarred. It was what he was doing. And one day, that damn ground was blowing. I was getting ready to go stop it from blowing, and I left the house. And I knew who went by, and I just quit. And I went back to the house, and I said, well, I thought you were going to do it. No, there's no reason for me to do it. I don't know who's going to own this ground. I said, they're appraising it today. And Mr. Carlson, we had an appointment with him that night, and he said, told us that you and your folks are the ones that took care of Uncle Anthony, and that's true. My mom cooked and washed his clothes, hauled him to the train. He rode a train back and forth. And we had the opportunity to own that farm. He says, we don't want very much money down, but we want to write a contract. Well, they had it appraised, and it was appraised right. It wasn't over-appraised at the time. And I don't even remember for sure who it was did it. And they wanted $10,000 down. I said, sir, I don't even have $10, really. He said, well, see what you can do. See what you can do. Well, John and Margaret, my folks, got the $10,000, and we wrote up a contract. And then I put it all in what they had then, and they called it a soil bank, which is a grass program like they have today. And I put enough of it in to make the payments. So I sure had money enough to make the payments. Well, you don't live very good or do very much on 129 acres of ground to farm. That's all we had left. And, one day, Susie was in the hospital. She had had a miscarriage. She had several. John was born when we lived in Truesdale. And I went in, and he was mad, and he got all over me. He says, why didn't you tell us that we were about to lose that farm? I said, what are you talking about? He told me, and I says, ring up the telephone, call Bill Ellison. I had made that payment, and he told Bill, John, that I had. Well, about that time, you know, all the mail went on the railroad. There was a bag of mail that was dropped or lost somewhere between here and California, and that check was in that mail. They reissued it and canceled the payment on that check, and so that we got out of that storm, but. You know, we didn't. I did it work. You couldn't rent ground. You couldn't do anything. We made it on what cattle I had. I remember one time I was out there with a one-way, and one-way down some pretty good-looking wheat. Lloyd Miller, a friend of mine, Daryl Miller's dad, stopped and he came over and got on the track and he said, "Jake, you can't do this." I says, "I have to." He says, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to go to work for somebody this winter, and I won't have any feed if I don't plant this ground here to feed so I can have some cattle." And he just shook his head and got off, and I kept going. And we made it with the cattle. I made a lot of sale barns, but I bought and sold them all, you know, all ones we had. And at the same time, Emil Fisher came by, the person I talked to, and he wanted to talk me into going to the consistory. I'm a Blue Mason, belong to the lodge. And one man goes, I said, "No, I won't do it." He said, "Take one of them heifers out there. That's about $150, that was." I said, "You know, if I take a critter out of that pen and go to Wichita the consistory," I said, "I can't do that." He said, "Why can't you?" I said, "Emma, we don't have a television set. If I'm going to take a heifer or a critter out of that pen, I'm going to buy something so our whole family can benefit by it." He never bothered me again. But, you know, that's our first years out of the service. It worked. We're still here. I've got a little money put away, and I don't owe anybody. My dad owed everybody. My mom died. She had some money and didn't owe anybody. So we worked hard and made it work. Thanks to Susie. She rode a tractor. She didn't ever run a combine. She helped work cattle. She did everything that came along. And I'd say that's telling you more than I thought I'd tell you. There were some colored people that owned ground and lived over by Truesdale. They had a quarter of ground when they left there, and I think they went to Pratt. I'm not sure. But they call it the colored quarter, the Negro quarter, whatever way. Then the ones that was here.
What time period was that about?
Well, that'd been when I was in school or at
so, right before the war.
Yeah, or during it. And then the other ones were here in they lived here in town, you know, which I didn't know. I didn't know who they were. If you talk about somebody south of the river, or someplace south of the river, I can tell you.
Did you go to school with Negro children?
Not in high school. Grade school or high school? No. Not until I went to college.
How about the Hispanic population? Did you have Hispanics in that area?
No. They all lived in Lewis. And those people are still here. The Castanedas, the Negrettis. To me, they've always been here. They're part of us, as I put it. The other ones I don't know because I don't know where they came from. Not that it matters. There's a lot of good people everywhere. But in the military, we had my best friends was a colored man that helped me the most. One of the worst ones was a colored man. This one I told you stole so much, he was white. But, you know, I didn't get involved in it until I was in the service. And there was never a time where there was a problem that I got involved in I'd do what I had to do and stay away from the rest of it. If that answers your question on the colored people. But the people that own this ground, I didn't ever really know. You know, we had three communities down there. And
what were the communities?
Centerview, Truesdale, and Fellsburg.
And was there a church base of any of that, or an ethnic? Was there German, English, or what?
I don't know. And
now
all three of them had churches. I can remember as a little kid running around Fellsburg, there was two widow women there, and they smoked pipes, corn cob pipes. And you talk about staring at you, they'd look you down. They didn't want you around. They don't get in any trouble. One of them was named Grandma Bratchett. The other one was named Grandma Myers.
And have enough other things.